Welcome to Nightlights. This is David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, we'll be listening to the music of four jazz composers who undertook extended portrayals of the Black experience from Africa to slavery to freedom. It's Sweet History, Duke Ellington, Oliver Nelson, John Carter, Wynton Marsalis, and the African-American Odyssey, coming up on this edition of Nightlights.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington with three dances from his Black, Brown, and Beige suite, West Indian Dance, Emancipation Celebration, and Sugar Hill Penthouse, three short pieces that he recorded in 1944 as part of an 18-minute studio version of the suite. West Indian Dance represented the influence of black slaves and laborers from the Caribbean region. Emancipation Celebration reflected the feelings of slaves upon gaining their freedom after the Civil War. And Sugar Hill Penthouse depicted the relatively affluent life of some African Americans in a part of 20th century Harlem. We're playing extended musical portraits of African American history on this edition of Nightlights, focusing on four composers: Duke Ellington, Oliver Nelson, John Carter, and Wynton Marsalis, beginning with Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, which Ellington debuted at Carnegie Hall in 1943 and first recorded in 1944. It is an inaugural musical monument in the genre of extended jazz works, and Ellington had been building towards it for years, writing longer pieces such as Reminiscing in Tempo and the musical review Jump for Joy in 1941. The Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s had inspired a number of black artists to begin to explore their African heritage and the black experience in America, from enslavement to the difficulties of life after emancipation and the migration for many to cities in the North. And in 1931, Ellington told a reporter, "I'm going to compose a musical evolution of the Negro race." Cultural historian Michael McGurr.
Ellington did have some predecessors. Certainly the great Harlem Stride pianist James P. Johnson had been interested in writing about more directly about the black experience. James Reese Europe, Will Marion Cook, leaders of black ragtime and creators of black orchestras in the 1910s and 20s were interested in those things too. And, of course, Scott Joplin had written that last opera of his, Tremonisha, which never quite happened in his lifetime as he had hoped. But I have to say, as an academic, that you can get too academic-y about Ellington's background and what inspired him. He was creative, and he sensed an opportunity to write about black history and black aspirations and do it in a way that could be commercially acceptable, which is why he could bring his projects to fruition, why he could keep doing this and truly not offend people while moving toward this majestic statement about black history in the midst of World War II, Black, Brown, and Beige.
And now comes our latest attempt, probably our most serious attempt, and definitely our longest composition. However, in mentioning the length of Black, Brown, and Beige, we would like to say that this is a parallel to the history of the American Negro, and of course, it tells a long story. And I hope that you will take into consideration the fact that in telling the story of the work song, for instance, which is the first theme, we use it in its many forms. For instance, when, you know, the work song is sung while you work, of course, there's a place for the song, and then there's a place to grunt, you know, and the impact of your work. And, of course, after that comes the spiritual theme, which is the second theme of the first movement. And today we find that the two are very closely related, and so it naturally necessitates developing the two and showing their close relationship. The first movement of Black, Brown, and Beige is called Black. Thank you.
Duke Ellington with the 1944 studio recording of Work Song from the Black, Brown, and Beige Suite, released in a lavish double 78 folio set that included three other pieces from the suite. And we also heard Ellington's spoken introduction from a January 1943 performance of the suite in Boston. Although Black, Brown, and Beige had long been on Ellington's mind, he had written the bulk of it in a brief burst of activity before the debut at Carnegie. The suite, drawing upon swing, blues, spiritual, and classical influences, was received enthusiastically by the sold-out, overflowing crowd, but New York critics were less receptive. Paul Bowles called it formless and meaningless, while John Briggs of the New York Post said, Mr. Ellington was saying musically the same thing he had said earlier in the evening, and this time he took 45 minutes to do it. Jazz impresario John Hammond was moved to write an article titled, Is the Duke Deserting Jazz? Cultural historian Michael McGurr.
I think Ellington, like a lot of popular artistic figures, maybe even sports figures and politicians too, suffered the consequences of his own buildup. By the time he played at Carnegie Hall, he'd been a star for 15 years. He'd been a critical darling for that period of time. He was built up to the point where people's expectations were ratcheted very high. I don't think he really suffered a backlash because of the content of Black, Brown, and Beige. It's interesting. Nobody said, how dare you write about black history? What they responded to more was the notion that he was placing himself with classical musicians by writing something seemingly symphonic. And by that standard, then, critics were going to want to criticize him. And yet the thing that was most daring, really, was to say, I want to make the history of my own people the center of my music in an open way. And that didn't get condemned.
McGurr also says that Ellington's successful career was a paradoxical factor in the writing of Black, Brown, and Beige.
The fact that Ellington had such a popular band that he could use as an instrument meant not only that he had a group of people to play his music, but it also meant that he had a kind of continuous visibility in the culture that other black musicians didn't tend to have. The downside of that for him, the disadvantage, was that he had to run this band. And it meant that Black, Brown, and Beige was, in the end, a very hurried piece of work. He was still working on it to the end. He had the themes, but he was still struggling with many of the transitions, the things that he needed to make this a very effective long piece. He paid a price for it at Carnegie Hall. It was a big splashy event. But there are critics who reacted adversely to the very raw, hurried nature of the piece.
In spite of this, Ellington's appearance at Carnegie in 1943 was considered a success and led to further such appearances in extended works.
It established him on a new level as a respectable artistic figure who was worthy of the kind of adulation of a classical musician, but also who had a kind of national political significance. That with that Carnegie concert, he weds a classical setting to black themes, and it makes it possible for him to become a frequent writer about just those themes again. He would write New World A-Coming, The Liberian Suite, Harlem, about the black community in New York, My People, and on, and he would do it in an increasingly world stage, in part for just the things that he'd established at that concert in New York at Carnegie Hall in 43.
It took decades for Black, Brown, and Beige to achieve its critical status, and decades as well for its initial live performance to be released on LP, but it was still an artistic and cultural milestone for Ellington, and one that did not go unnoticed by other jazz artists, even if they couldn't or wouldn't follow in the Duke's footsteps. Michael McGurr on the precedent that Ellington's suite set.
Ellington made it much, much easier to write political music. Not right away. He did not have many companions. You can see music often as quite a copycat business, you know, just as in 1967 there were all these rock bands that wanted to do their own version of Sgt. Pepper. There are not many jazz musicians, certainly not many band leaders in the 40s and into the 50s who were ready to essay what Ellington had done. And at the same time, the civil rights movement wasn't quite there yet.
Nearly 20 years after Duke Ellington debuted Black, Brown, and Beige, saxophonist and composer Oliver Nelson wrote and recorded Afro-American Sketches. Unlike Ellington, Nelson initially took on his project reluctantly after a record label representative suggested it to him. In the liner notes to the record, he stated that he was put off by what he perceived to be a lack of honesty in Afro-jazz records of the times and thought himself unqualified to write such a work. But he immersed himself in studies of African music to write the early parts of the suite and drew upon his own big band experiences for composing the parts that reflected black life in America. We'll hear one such section now, depicting the disappointed but persevering life of Southern blacks who had migrated to northern cities. Disillusioned by Oliver Nelson on Nightlights.
Thank you.
Saxophonist and composer Oliver Nelson leading a big band in performance of Disillusion from his 1961 suite Afro-American Sketches, that piece portraying the disappointments and challenges facing Black Americans who migrated to the North in hopes of finding a better life. We'll have more music from Oliver Nelson in just a few moments, as well as clarinetist and composer John Carter. Production support for Nightlights comes from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. This is David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Sweet History on Nightlights. We're playing excerpts from extended musical portrayals of African-American history on this edition of Nightlights, focusing on works written and recorded by Duke Ellington, John Carter, Wynton Marsalis, and Oliver Nelson. Nelson, composer of the suite Afro-American Sketches, would later seemingly acknowledge Ellington's earlier work with the title of his Martin Luther King tribute, Black, Brown, and Beautiful. Afro-American Sketches was recorded in 1961, the year that the Freedom Riders were struggling to strike a blow against segregation in the Deep South. In a few moments, we'll hear a piece from that album, Freedom Dance, which Nelson dedicated to the thousands of militant youths, freedom riders of all races, and all people with the desire and maturity to be free. Michael McGurr on Oliver Nelson.
For someone like Oliver Nelson, who really had aspirations as a composer and arranger, who ultimately was more important, really, as a writer than as a player, Ellington was a tough act to follow. I do think in that sense Ellington was beyond category, and it was difficult to occupy that place. Nelson, interestingly, was an especially politically engaged man, was known for it, was closer to politics than many musicians tended to be.
Oliver Nelson with Freedom Dance, a variation and expansion of the same theme heard in Disillusioned from the 1961 album Afro-American Sketches. As the civil rights movement gained momentum in the 1960s, jazz artists began to incorporate its themes into their work more often. Max Roach and Oscar Brown Jr.'s Freedom Now Suite is one such example. This era also saw the rise of free jazz, a genre whose name connoted freedom in more ways than one. Michael McGurr notes that the new ways of thinking about music and politics may have influenced the compositional themes that younger artists pursued.
Ellington and the civil rights movement were trying to locate African-American civil rights in a long sweep of black history, whereas the Black Power movement, for all of its emphasis on an African past, emphasized the moment and confrontation in the here and now in a way that was different, and I don't think somehow lent itself to the same kind of long-term reflection that Ellington had sustained.
One artist whose origins are associated with the 1960s free jazz movement did go on to write an extended musical history of the African-American experience, the biggest of them all, a five-album suite composed by clarinetist John Carter. Carter called his work Roots and Folklore, episodes in the development of American folk music. What the African brought with him gave way to the blues, church music, jazz, rock, and all forms of American music, Carter stated, and I wanted to contribute some musical thoughts of my own in an artistic, historical way. Critic Gary Giddens calls Roots and Folklore a capacious vision of America's motley musical history. Fields, one of the albums making up the suite, counters the prevailing lack of ambition and fear of innovation that stifled so much recording during the 1980s. Describing the obstacles jazz artists of that decade faced in gaining record company support for large orchestral and innovative projects, Giddens says Carter solved the first problem by voicing his musicians in such a way as to suggest a larger group, and the second by refusing to accept the idea that by virtue of recording, he is in the business of producing marketable product. Michael McGurr.
I think that by the 70s and the 80s, jazz music obviously had passed its commercial prime. The kind of balance that Ellington could find back in the 40s of having great popularity and yet being able to do musically challenging things that could be commercially viable, that was long gone. Jazz music was on its way to trying to survive largely within a framework of respectability as America's classical music, which is what Wynton Marsalis was up to with Blood on the Fields. You had to be tapped into that kind of mainstream cultural apparatus, I think, to get the music heard. Carter went in an opposite direction that was much more communally rooted, which was one of the legacies of the Black Power movement, which had, you think of the beginnings of the Black Panthers in Oakland, and then as they moved elsewhere, emerged elsewhere, their style was to be very much rooted in the needs of the culture of the local community. You can see Carter's music as a survival of that communal impetus, but that was a hard road to hoe.
Thank you.
John Carter with selections from his 5-album suite Roots and Folklore, episodes in the development of American folk music. We heard City Streets from Shadows on a Wall, Children of the Fields from Fields, and Evening Prayer from Castles of Ghana. Unlike John Carter, trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis has had a high-profile and controversial career ever since his emergence as the leader of the so-called Young Lions movement in the early 1980s. In the mid-1990s, Marsalis tried his hand at an extended suite depicting African-American history with Blood on the Fields, a 3-CD recording that tells the story of a slave couple's journey to freedom. Blood on the Fields won the 1997 Pulitzer Prize for Music, but some critics had harsh words for the work. Gary Giddens called it an exercise in unqualified hubris, a discursive pastiche in which a broad range of influences is welded but not integrated, ingested but not digested. Michael McGurr offers a more sympathetic view.
Blood on the Fields is a fascinating piece of music. Marsalis is so embedded in controversy that it's really hard for any of us to strip it all away and hear him for the musician that he is or maybe that he isn't. Marsalis is also working at a particularly difficult point in time, it seems to me, and doesn't quite get credit for what he's done. He's writing at a time when black activism has a history and has a heritage, and in a new way that isn't simply commemorating a slave past, as he does here, and I don't mean that that's simple, but is also having to deal with the 20th century inheritance of black struggle in the cause of freedom. And it means that Marsalis has to be backward-looking in a certain way. in time. And I think for critics, that's too easily tied to their sense that he's backward-looking musically, that he's going back to a pre-free jazz, pre-1965 kind of happy medium of late swing and bop and hard bop. And that's not entirely fair. He's reflecting, I think, a very difficult political position of African-American freedom movement by the 80s and the 90s.
Living and a token, packing and a sacking, picking and a hoeing, seeding and a feeding, plowing and a growing. All day long, I raise my head to sky, beat back down my sun, burning days, the field hands cry, I split my fingers down to watching over me. To get free, cruel hot sun,
it's just begun
all day long. Learn on the field, ain't God.
Wynton Marsalis performing Work Song, featuring vocalist Cassandra Wilson and trombonist Wycliffe Gordon, from Marsalis' Pulitzer Prize-winning Blood on the Fields. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Michael McGurra and David Miller. You can listen to this and previous Nightlights programs and view playlists, jazz news, and commentaries on our website at nightlights.indiana.edu. Production support for Nightlights comes from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. Nightlights is engineered by Michael Paskash and produced in the studios of WFIU at Indiana University. This is David Brent Johnson wishing you good listening for the week ahead.